listeners, welcome back to another episode of Drinking from the Toilet, the podcast about the reality of training with positive reinforcement. I'm your host, Hannah Brannigan. This week, I hope you'll bear with me. If you thought previous episodes were extraordinarily geeky, this one may set a new standard. So I hope you liked that before, because there's more of it coming now. If you thought previous episodes were boring, then probably go ahead and turn it off and move on to something more interesting. So last week, we talked to Dr. Susan Friedman about motivation, and the concept of motivating operations came up, but we never really clearly defined it, at least not good enough for me. And I feel like motivation and motivating operations are such big ideas that it's worth pulling them apart and taking a few episodes to really unpack. These are concepts that have a big influence on what we do with our training and what we see and what we observe and how we talk about it. So I hope you also think that this is a good thing to talk about. And I hope, well, I'm going to do my best to convince you that this isn't all a big waste of time. This is one of those concepts, one of those ideas where I really think if we can all wrap our heads around it, get used to the language and use it effectively, we're going to really be able to move the whole field forward. So what is a motivating operation? When I first heard this term, which I talked about a little bit in front of Dr. Friedman, but I was maybe a little bit embarrassed to say that initially, I dismissed it. I'm not a fan of unnecessary jargon, right? I don't think that it's helpful to use words that are just unnecessary big words. I'm all about clear communication. I want to use the most effective words to communicate precisely what I'm talking about so that whoever I'm talking to knows what it is. Like, we're on the same page, right? And when I first heard about a motivating operation, I thought, well, psh, whatever, who really cares? Okay, so let's start with a definition. So a motivating operation describes how the value of reinforcement changes under certain circumstances. And this is something we've all observed many times in many different occasions, both with ourselves, with dogs that we're working with, or other species. We've all experienced situations where the dog's really interested in food and then turn around another situation, he's not really taking food. I can think of off the top of my head three occasions in the last week where Rugby was super into playing with a toy, playing tug with me at home, and then I take him to another training center or a seminar or a workshop, and he's not even looking at the toy. So what's the difference there? What things are affecting him so that he'll tug with me? The tugging behavior is really reinforcing to him, really probable, really highly likely to occur in my yard. And then if I take him to my friend's training room, he won't tug at all. Why is that different? And how can we explore and be really systematic about what's going on there? We've all experienced that. There are situations where I'm really hungry, like, oh, you know, I really want some chips. I think I might be having a fry emergency. I need to go through the McDonald's drive-thru right now. In that state, French fries become very highly motivating for me, right? They're really reinforcing, and I'm highly likely to do behaviors that will access French fries to me. Other situations, I've just read, you know, a really scientific book about the paleo lifestyle, and I would never eat a French fry. I don't ever eat French fries. I eat salads and lean beef and that sort of thing. So what we're interested in, what we find motivating, what we're reinforced by, these things change in different circumstances. And the motivating operation is a way to talk about that. And this is a concept that was originally described by Dr. Jack Michael in the 1980s. In fact, the first paper I was able to turn up talking about this was published in 1982. And it actually referenced back to some of B.F. Skinner's work in the 30s, where he talked about the third variable, and which I thought actually was kind of cool. So there's the idea that there's our consequence that we're working for, there's the cue, and then there's something else going on. And what is that, and how can we talk about it? So a motivating operation is something that happens that changes how much you, air quote, want the reinforcer and how hard you are willing to, air quote, work to get it. So we're talking about internal desires here, which is kind of complicated, right? That's hard, but also important. So in fact, it is considered the fourth term in that operant conditioning contingency. So you're familiar with the three-term contingency, right? So the ABC of operant conditioning, antecedent, behavior, consequence. Well, there is in the literature this idea of a fourth term, right? A fourth item. So we have the antecedent, we have the behavior, the consequence. That's three. Number four is motivation. So instead of ABC, it becomes MABC. So MABC, but nobody pronounces that. So don't even worry about it. It's just motivation, cue, behavior, consequence. Because the conditions that the animal is in, the subject, the person, the learner, is in at the time that the antecedent, behavior, and consequence occur, that affects how all of this plays out. And that's what motivation is. So why does this even matter? So this is the part where I'm going to try to get you to buy into listening to me here. So we've been going for like 6-7 minutes now, and you're already probably turning me off. But if you're still with me, I hope you'll keep listening, because I do actually think that this is important. So we all know that motivation is critical to training. Reinforcement drives behavior. The more the animal wants the reinforcer that I can control, the more he's willing to work to earn it, the more leverage I have in the training session. So I can build stronger behaviors with stronger reinforcers. And the motivating operation is what determines the strength of that reinforcer. How much does he want it? And this is the part where I can get kind of hung up, right? I get a little bit tangled up in how we talk about how we train dogs, because every trainer knows that motivation is critical. And so every trainer has a bag of tricks about how they motivate dogs, how they get stuff to happen. And it usually comes along with some narrative of how their tricks are working, right? So it's whatever it is that you're doing, the game that you're playing, the word game, air quotes again, is used a lot in dog training. And most of these games, air quotes, are really taking advantage of motivating operations. And the language, the terminology around motivating operations gives us a way to systematically talk about what it is that we're seeing, what we're doing, how we're affecting these reinforcers to get the motivating effect that we want. And that is so important, because otherwise it's just that. It's just a bag of tricks and nobody knows why it's working or how it's working. Well, if you're listening, you probably care how it's working. You probably care why it's working. I know I do. So I want to know, how does this all fit? And how can I take this apart and reverse engineer it so that I can use it to further my own training in situations that don't exactly match? And by understanding how it works, that puts me in a better situation where I can do it. Talking about it in terms of motivating operations, and this is my favorite part about it, is it lets us point to the environmental conditions, things that we can observe, things that we can measure, things that we can control, rather than guessing at an internal state, which I can't really directly influence. So when I'm designing a training plan, I really want to be thinking about, how can I change? What are the variables that I can change to maximize the motivation for this dog, this individual, this particular dynamic, my dog, me, working together to build this particular behavior? What are the things that I can control? Because I can't change who he is. I can't change how he was born. But it turns out, again, there's a lot of things that I can change. And if I have a way to talk about that, then I'm better equipped at changing those variables, controlling those aspects that I can control. So back in the 1980s, Dr. Jack Michaels originally used the term establishing operation. So if you're really into this kind of thing and you want to go Google it, you're going to run across a lot of early articles that talk about establishing operations. In fact, I even came across some from the 2000s, which use the term establishing operations. And what we're really talking about here again is motivating operations. These are kind of used as synonyms. And what we're talking about is any variable, whether it's a deprivation of something that you want, food deprivation, water deprivation, social deprivation, any aversive stimulus that you want to avoid, anything unpleasant, uncomfortable, being too warm, being too cold, eating a bunch of salt, working, running really far, running really hard, all of these sorts of things that give you biological sensations. And then also variables that have an effect because of some kind of learning history. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between those two, and doesn't really matter for our purposes exactly, but it encompasses that whole area. So a motivating operation is any variable that changes how reinforcing you find some stimulus, object, or event, any reinforcer, and also changes how frequently the probability that you will exhibit any behavior that has gained access to that reinforcer, stimulus, object, or event in the past. So I feel like this is fairly easy to understand, even intuitively, when we talk about food, way harder when we talk about other things. So let's talk about food first. So if you haven't eaten in a while, food is really motivating. Maybe you've been trying to record this podcast all morning. You keep getting interrupted. You haven't actually eaten anything since 6:30 this morning, and it's well past lunchtime and you're starving. You're really likely to wander in the kitchen and engage in rummaging behavior in the cabinets, right? I mean, not me, you, right? And if your rummaging behavior should be reinforced with a half a bag of stale pretzels, you're going to feel pretty reinforced, because under these circumstances, a half a bag of stale pretzels is really reinforcing compared to another situation where maybe you've just eaten. We're in the smack middle of the holiday season right now, and there's a lot of situations where you may have eaten a lot of food very recently. And if you've just eaten a lot, you're way less likely to do food-motivated behaviors, so you're much less likely to go rummaging around in the kitchen in the first place. And should you, while rummaging, turn up a half a bag of stale pretzels, you're not going to find that as reinforcing because you're full. So that condition of how long it's been since you've just eaten and your recent caloric intake changes how valuable a half a bag of pretzels are. Now imagine you've been, there's a movie that I saw a preview for because I don't watch this kind of movie, where these people get plane crashed in the middle of these mountains, right? So for these people who have crashed their plane in the middle of remote mountains, they have no food, resources, people, whatever. For them, a half a bag of pretzels, no matter how stale, is probably incredibly valuable compared to a normal person living in the middle of their normal life, in the middle of their city where they have access to a grocery store, right? Like, that's just not that big of a deal. You're like, oh, I would eat pretzels, but not if they're stale. So the conditions change how much we care about the thing. And it's really important to remember that behaviors always have a function. We don't just behave in the hopes that they'll be randomly reinforced. Like, the only reason we behave is because we're trying to get something specific. I am doing things right now because I want something to happen. So I'm not rummaging around in the kitchen to achieve approval of my husband or friends on Facebook. In fact, I'd be embarrassed if my friends on Facebook saw some of the things that I do at home when I'm hungry, but we won't talk about that. I'm only doing so to get food, to satisfy that hungriness that I feel. If I cook dinner with an actual entree and vegetables and side dishes, it's because I want the food, not because I want my husband to think I'm a good wife. Let's just be perfectly clear here. Fish bicycle. I don't need him and I don't care about his approval. So if I do the thing, it's because I want food. That's the function of my behavior. And that's always going to play into when we do stuff and why we do it and how frequently we perform the behavior. I perform behaviors more frequently in situations where I want the function of that behavior more, right? Okay, so Dr. Friedman suggested this idea of antecedent influencers as a broader topic of which motivating operations are part of. Go back and listen to that episode where we talk about that. It is something I'm not super comfortable talking about. In fact, this whole episode is solidly in kind of an area where I'm kind of sorry that I even started talking about it, because I had to do a lot of research to even discuss it to this point, and it just gets shakier from here. But Dr. Riemann talks about the idea of antecedent influencers, and I had to Google it. There's a lot of stuff that I'm going to talk about today that I had to go and Google, and that's one of them. And I was a little bit mind blown at first because, well, it confused me because I'm used to that ABC contingency of operant conditioning, where the A, the antecedent, is basically the cue. So how is an antecedent influencer? What's this third variable, four-term contingency thing? How does this all fit together? So I decided to do some digging because it's super confusing to me, but I could also kind of feel how this was going to be an important concept for us to talk about. So usually when we're talking about the A, in that ABC, we're talking about the antecedent, we're talking about cues. And when we talk about cues, as mentioned in previous episodes, what we really are talking about is that discriminative stimulus or stimuli, if there's more than one. So SD, right? So the discriminative stimulus means reinforcement is available for a particular response, right? You do a behavior and you get the reinforcer. The light goes on, you do the thing, you get the food pellet. So if the light turns on in your Skinner box, you push the lever and the food pellet drops out. So the discriminative stimulus tells you when reinforcement is available and for what behavior reinforcement will be available to you for. That was a terrible sentence. Ignore that part. Okay. So one of the examples that was used a lot in all of the articles that I read about motivating operations is the example of feeling thirsty, being deprived of water. So most organisms need water in some form or other beverages, if you know what I'm saying. So being thirsty does not change whether or not water is available. It only changes how much you care about water. So right now, I'm sitting in my house. We have a well pump. We've had power, knock on wood, for the last 24 hours. So the well pump is functional. I could access water at any time. Water is completely available to me all the time. All I have to do is get up and walk over to the faucet and turn the faucet on, which sometimes feels like a really long distance, but ignore that part. So water is available to me. Most of the time, I don't really care about water. But when I've tried to record a podcast for, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, I have lost count at this point. But so I've ultimately been talking for more than 40 minutes without a sip of liquid. Water starts to become more valuable to me. And so as I start to feel my throat feel a little bit tired, as I start to feel my mouth dry out, my interest in water increases. The likelihood that I will actually get up from my very comfortable desk chair and walk out of this room down the hall to the kitchen and turn on the faucet, it's a higher and higher probability, right? More and more likely that I'm going to get up. I'm going to feel enough motivation at this point to stop trying to record a podcast and walk into the kitchen and get a glass of water, because I eventually just, my mouth will turn to dust and I won't be able to make a single word. So none of that changes whether or not water is available. I can get the water at any time. It's only relevant in that, how much do I care about the water? So the longer I go talking without a drink, the more I want to go get a drink. And so the more water, access to it, becomes valuable without changing the availability of it. So that's really our definition of what a discriminative stimulus, a cue, is. A cue means reinforcement is available for doing this thing. And when the cue is not present, reinforcement is not available. So that's literally the definition of a cue, a discriminative stimulus. You get reinforced when the cue is on. There's no reinforcement when the cue is off. So a cue, discriminative stimulus, is all about availability of the reinforcement contingent on the correct response. And this is a completely separate thing from how much you care about whether or not you get the reinforcer that behavior might access, right? Okay, so let's move on. So that's two. So we got antecedents. We're divided into two general categories. One determines of antecedents how much you care about the thing, and the other one determines when you get access to the thing. So we've got motivation and cues all kind of under this antecedent umbrella. Now, let's look at the motivating operation specifically. Put cues off to one side, put it on the shelf, because we do care a lot about cues, and we'll talk more about cues in another episode. So put cues up on a shelf. Now we're going to talk about motivating operations. So the concept of motivating operations is divided into two general categories. We're just going to keep splitting things down, and you know how much I love doing this, so I get really kind of excited. But okay, I'm going to control myself. So motivating operations is divided into two general categories. One is the unconditioned motivating operation. You're going to be very familiar with this because we've talked about classical conditioning and the unconditioned stimulus. And the conditioned motivating operation. So we've got two, either it's conditioned or unconditioned. The unconditioned motivating operation doesn't need to be learned. So this is going to pair up pretty closely with what we consider primary reinforcers, unconditioned stimulus, stuff that you come already, you're born, you've already got it on board. You don't need to learn it. You already have it installed. It's pre-installed on your Apple Watch or whatever. So really obvious examples are things like, you don't need to learn anything to figure out that when you're hungry, food solves your problem. Right? If you're thirsty, water solves your problem. If you have big feelings about stuff with your family or your in-laws, food may also solve your problem. But that's not going to be an unconditioned motivating operation, I don't think. I would probably classify that as a conditioned motivating operation, even though there's some overlap there. But again, I digress. So other obvious examples, right? These are things that are going to pop into your head as obvious things that make you care more or less about access to something. If you feel too hot or being too warm, I'm using the word feel here, and that's probably not helpful. That's probably more confusing because feeling is something that happens on the inside, and temperature is something that we can actually measure on the outside. So just being too warm, being in a warm environment, will increase the reinforcing value of access to cooling off, right? Jumping in a pool, going into air conditioning. I grew up in a house that it was an old house. It did not have air conditioning. In fact, I had asthma because I was that kid, right? I was short, I was plumpy, I had glasses, I had short hair, and I had asthma. So yes, like Piggy in Lords of the Fly, I had asthma. And so my family did eventually put a little window unit in the house so that they at least would save some hassle that way. But I grew up in a house that did not have air conditioning, and they actually got central air after I went to college. Not because I'm so old that central air hadn't been invented yet. That's just the life that I lived, right? So for me, air conditioning, climate control is a very high value reinforcer. I grew up without it. It seems like a really big deal. My own child probably takes it for granted. But for me, that's a really high value reinforcer. I remember going to a movie theater in order to enjoy the air conditioning in the summer. Anyways, again, digression. Let's stay on topic. Same thing, being too cold. I'm recording this watching snow and sleet fall outside my window at a toasty 31 degrees just outside. I am inside my house at a extremely comfortable 64 degrees. Yes, I still live in an old house because I apparently didn't learn my lesson, and this is the best we can do. But being cold increases the value of warming up. So when I walked in here to record this, the first thing I did, I snapped on that space heater. So at the very least, there's an 18-inch radius around my ankles that is burning while the rest of my body is shivering. That is what it is to live in an old house. So being cold increases the value of warming up. Water deprivation. You feel thirsty. You've not had water in a while. You're getting dehydrated. Increases the value of water. They also include things like oxygen deprivation. I can't really imagine a scenario like that, except for, I guess, perhaps, well, I was a swimmer through most of my youth and into college. I swam in college. It was NCAA sport at my school, and I did participate there. And so I was a sprinter, and we weren't allowed to breathe during certain workouts. And so during those workouts, yes, actually, being able to breathe was a valuable reinforcer, now that I think about it. In fact, don't take it for granted. Sleep deprivation. Do you have a young child? Because I have a young child, and I still remember what it was like. Even though I worked a full day, the only food she took was directly from the tap, and that meant from whenever I got home in the afternoon until the next morning when I left. Yes, so sleep deprivation is a very valuable, very, very powerful motivating operation, which means that I have a lot of feelings around sleep. Again, that's like a whole nother podcast episode, probably not even this actual podcast, probably somebody else's podcast. We can talk about that. But anyways, if you've not had access to regular sleep at some time in the past, sleep becomes really, really valuable. And you start thinking about, like, what if I just got a hotel room for the night just so that I could sleep for 8 hours, like not at prom or anything, but just to turn everything off for 8 hours. Anyways, let's move on. So those are unconditioned reinforcers. Those are things, unconditioned reinforcers, unconditioned motivating operations are directly related to biological functions. That makes it easy, right? It's stuff you don't even really have to think about. This is just stuff that you already want. Conditioned motivating operations, that's where these learned reinforcers come into play. And that's where it gets kind of cool and kind of complicated. And I get a little bit excited. So I've already decided on a scope for this particular episode. We're hitting 30 minutes pretty close, and I'm going to try and stay on topic. So a conditioned motivating operation, these are things that you had to learn, you had experience with in order for them to be effective. And the conditioned motivating operation itself, this category, is divided into three additional categories. You can see how this gets kind of fun for me, because we start with the one and we break it into two, and then that breaks into two, and then this breaks into three. Okay, so there are three categories. There is the surrogate conditioned motivating operation, the transitive conditioned motivating operation and the reflexive conditioned motivating operation. Now, this is the point where I actually think the jargon becomes unhelpful. I do think that it's helpful in knowing that all motivating operations fall into these three categories, because again, that gives us a way to talk systematically about what's happening, but memorizing the terms, not so helpful, especially since the actual terms that, I assume this was Dr. Jack Michaels, who's probably still alive, but will hopefully never hear this podcast, picked. And I just, again, I find those words super unhelpful in remembering which one is which. I am, however, going to talk about each of the three because, again, thinking about how my motivation changes and how my dog's motivation changes really helps me in thinking about how I plot out my training plans. So let's start with the first one. This is the surrogate conditioned motivating operation, or CMOS. And this borrows a lot from our basic Pavlovian classical conditioning, right? So this is where we have an initial neutral stimulus, something doesn't really mean anything to you by itself, but by pairing it with some other response, some other scenario, it takes on the meaning of that context. So my favorite example that I have run across so far is the idea that you're at home, and you have a way more energy efficient house than I do. And so your house is maintained at a warm temperature. And you turn on a Hallmark movie, a Christmas movie. And in the Christmas movie, it's snowing. And all of a sudden, you really want a blanket. You want to snuggle up in a blanket on the sofa while you watch that movie. It has nothing to do with the temperature because you're already warm. Why would you want a blanket? Blankets are for getting warmer. And yet, you already want a blanket just because you're watching these people in the snow in this Hallmark movie. And that was a pretty good example because this totally resonates for me. I also wonder if that might have something to do with why every time I get in the car to start driving, I feel like I need a snack. Even if I just ate lunch, like if I just ate lunch, I get in the car, I start driving, all of a sudden I kind of want a snack. And if I'm on actually a trip, maybe this happens to other people, but it certainly happens to me if I'm driving like let's say to a seminar or a dog show or something like that. I always have a cooler that is full of food. And when I pack the cooler, I intend for that cooler to last me the entire weekend. And I inevitably eat it in the first 30 minutes of driving. And I don't know why I'm so hungry, because it does not seem to matter if I ate a big breakfast, if I stopped at Bojangles and I got a chicken biscuit and some fries and I ate all of that too. None of that seems to matter, because when I start driving in the car, I hit the interstate, I am all of a sudden hungry and I need to eat a snack, and snacks become more reinforcing and my probability of performing snack accessing behavior increases. This is not an example that I ran across in any of the articles that I read, but it is one that instantly popped into my head when I was reading about CMOs, conditioned motivating operations. Okay, so that's one possible example. And I think that probably actually comes up in our dog training. I think there are situations where we have paired a certain context with eating food, and that makes food eating really likely. The same thing with playing with a toy, right? I think I've told the story before on this podcast where I would take my now middle child, Spark, out to the power line easement behind our house to throw a chuck ball for her. This started initially when I was pregnant and I was throwing up a lot, which that's its own CMO, but I would take her out there to throw the ball. And for years after, if I approached the same gate that went out of the kind of the dog potty yard area, went straight out into the power line easement, she would arouse like I was already holding a ball that I was going to throw, like I was holding the chuck it, even if I wasn't holding the chuck it. So it's kind of interesting. There's stuff going on there in the classical conditioned motivating operation area there. So just, again, something to think about. Okay, so let's move on to our second category of conditioned motivating operation, which is the CMOT, transitive conditioned motivating operation. And this is where something is either paired in time or it's paired in need. This is the one I'm a little bit fuzziest about, but I think it also accounts for the majority of what we observe, what we experience as a motivating operation. So here's an example. This is, again, one that I came up with, and it may be flawed, but I'm sure you guys will let me know, because I know that in addition to dog folks, I also have apparently, and surprisingly, a number of behavior analysts who also listen to this podcast, which makes me nervous. But anyways, all right, so CMOT. this is where you don't really care about something until something else happens. So here's an example. Do you find electrical outlets particularly reinforcing? So I usually don't. I'm sitting in my house. And honestly, despite the fact that actually my house has a very limited number of electrical outlets, again, the age of my house, electricity was added as an afterthought very recently, actually, surprisingly recently. We don't have that many outlets available. But most of the time, I don't even think about electrical outlets. I don't perform behavior to get access to electrical outlets. So I don't even think about it until my flight is delayed and I'm stuck in the Atlanta airport for 2, 3, 4 hours, and my phone is at 20%. And then the most important thing to me in that moment is finding and accessing a hot electrical outlet. It is the only thing that I care about in that moment. There may be people listening to this actual podcast that are trapped because of the weather and are sitting in an airport watching their phone battery percentage tick down 32, 31, 30, 29. Is this stressing anybody out? It stresses me out quite a lot, actually. And in fact, it's actually worked its way upstream as conditioned responses tend to, such that the second I land in any midpoint airport, right, anywhere I am connecting to another plane, I start looking for an outlet. It doesn't matter what percentage my phone is at. I've landed at an airport. I don't know when I'm getting home. It could be in 30 minutes. It could be in 3 days. There's no way of knowing, especially this time of year. And I am mapping out where the available electrical outlets are at any airport. In fact, if you're ever trapped in Atlanta, I know where they are. Newark, Minneapolis, I know where the electrical outlets are. And I will find them. And my behavior of searching for electrical outlets becomes very, very high probability at that time. The rest of the time doesn't matter. So that's a conditioned motivating operation, because until my phone went low and I wanted access to it, like especially if I forgot to download a new audiobook and now I'm faced with a long flight with no new audiobooks, I cannot cope with that, right? I need an outlet so that I can charge my phone, so that I can download an audiobook, so that I can have access to that for the remainder of my traveling time. Here's another example. Have you ever not really given a fig about a particular sport until you see a friend who owns a littermate of your dog post on Facebook about a new title that they've just earned? Have you ever not really been that interested? You're training your dog because you're very into the process and you got this dog because you love her and all you really want to do is train and enjoy the journey. But then your friend who owns her littermate posts about just achieving her agility championship title in some organization. And all of a sudden you're like, I've got to fix those weave pull entries because we got to get entered. Does it change your motivation for training those particular behaviors? Does it change your motivation for entering trials? This has not happened to me, of course. I've never experienced this, not even one time, not even for a second. But I've heard maybe it happening to other people. And so this would be another example of a CMOT, which you may be familiar with. There are lots of other examples, right? There's lots of situations where you didn't really care about having a spoon until you were sitting there with a cup of coffee and no way to stir it. There's lots of situations like that. And I suspect that these are also real for our dogs as well, and they're going to be relevant for our training. And then the final example, which I think is worth, it's kind of its own episode, and we might circle back to this in a little bit, is the idea of the reflexive conditioned motivating operation, the CMOR. And a CMOR is when there's some stimulus, some variable, something occurs that tells you that your life is about to get worse. So something happens, and it tells you that whatever your current state is, you're about to experience something that's not quite as good. Might be a little bit worse, might be a lot worse. So perhaps you're having a fun time playing a video game on your phone, and all of a sudden your phone rings, and your mother-in-law's number pops up on the caller ID. And you haven't answered yet, so you don't even know if she's calling to complain about it. I mean, of course she is. But let's say that you don't even know. You don't know for sure that she is, but the number on the caller ID, that stimulus, observing that on your phone, instantly puts you in a situation where your probability of phone answering behavior goes down. The reinforcing effect of answering the phone goes down a lot, maybe forever. Maybe you never answer the phone again. I don't know. Compare that to, of course, a situation where Publisher's Clearinghouse rings your phone. I'd pick up. Do they still do Publisher's Clearinghouse? I don't actually know. That's not really something that's been, but maybe we do lottery now, right? Powerball. Maybe Powerball rings your phone. Maybe that's on your phone ID. I don't know what that, this is, I've gone off track. But Anyways, there are caller IDs that will pop up on your phone that will decrease the probability that you will answer the phone and receive whatever reinforcement or punishment may be accessed there. And there are caller IDs that will pop up that may increase it. You know, I can't think of a single example. Honestly, I don't answer the phone. I considered the phone ringing to be kind of a CMOR. But anyways, usually CMOR is used for that kind of avoidance situation. Something has happened. It makes you feel like you need to avoid it. A good dog example. This was one that was mentioned to me by my friend Lindsay Wood Brown, who you heard in previous episodes. And this is the idea. You've already observed it. Your dog is very happy to take food until you start walking towards the bathroom or you pull out the hose and it starts looking like you're going to give the dog a bath. And when that happens, food is less interesting. Same thing happens. My dog's very interested in taking treats. I pick up the nail clippers. All of a sudden, I actually don't really care that much about food. I'd really rather go outside. So something has changed. That variable changes how much the dog cares about the food you have. It wants to avoid it. All of a sudden, avoidance and escape becomes a very high likelihood behavior. And anything that you can do to get away from that situation becomes very probable. This would all qualify as that reflexive, conditioned, motivating operation. This is also applicable for those situations where you walk the dog into an environment and all of a sudden they become less interested in eating food. Is it a dog show? Is it a vet? These scenarios function as reflexive, conditioned, motivating operations. These are things that affect how reinforcing the food actually is. So it's no longer a static variable. It's something that can change, and it can change a lot. And understanding how that can change and why lets us be more effective with our training. And the other thing that's kind of interesting to think about is the fact that so many of our human, particularly if you feel like you're moving away from the physical punishment realm, but so many of our human punishers involve deprivation of some kind of stimulus, something that your learner would normally want, and you're going to take that thing away. You know, you're restricting TV time, or you're putting the dog in the crate. There's a lot of sort of timeouty kind of stuff that we use as a punishment. And in order for that punishment to be effective, the taking away of the thing has to be important. And then, of course, now that you've taken it away, you've put your learner into a state of deprivation. Well, accessing it back becomes more valuable. And I'm not at all advocating that we should design training plans around the contingency of removing stuff that our learner wants. That's still punishment, and it would still have all of the same fallout associated with it. But think about this as it plays out in your daily life. Think about, you know, what are the things that my dog already wants, particularly in conjunction with the context, the times of day, the scenarios that you go through where you're not really having to do anything. I mentioned this in the previous podcast, and it's an observation that I've made a lot for my own dogs at home and for student dogs and for dogs that I don't even really know, but people talking about them. My own dogs, who are moderately interested in food most of the time, become ravening animals at dinner time, right? They become crazy. They become foaming, whining, spinning, chattering fools, even if the rest of the time I would bring out like raw steak or liver from a freshly, what, I don't even know. Let's not go there. But they would be like, oh, thank you. I really like this steak. This is very delicious. It's cooked just the way that I want it. Compared to how they behave at 5:45 in the evening, food becomes insanely motivating at that time. So there is a time of day, this would be a CMOT, transitive, where the food is more motivating than others. So again, I can use that to my advantage. I can pay attention to when my dogs are hungry or used to being hungry, and they're going to find that reinforcement more motivating. And that gives me that fourth term in my contingency, and I can use that to leverage for the purposes of my training and build stronger behaviors as a result. So these are just things that I want you to think about. There's not an easy answer. And again, everybody has their games, their tricks, their protocols that they use to optimize motivation, to maximize the reinforcing value of what we can control, because there's a lot of stuff that we can't, but there's a lot of stuff that we can. And as you are looking at a game that's being presented by another trainer, or you're looking at some recipe or procedure or protocol, you're thinking about applying something else, take a look. How is this affecting the motivating operations that your dog is exposed to? How is this therefore affecting the value of the reinforcement that you're using to maintain the behavior, or to build the behavior that you're trying to build? And just start paying attention to how playing with these variables changes that contingency, changes the outcomes that we have. And then as we start collecting information, we start collecting data, we can use that to our advantage to build stronger behavior, to build behavior more efficiently, and to be more effective as trainers. So anyway, this is a very, very brief review on a very complicated topic, and I hope it was at least a little bit helpful and not completely overwhelmingly boring. I did the best that I could. I'll keep trying. Anyways, I hope you haven't given up. I hope you'll come back next week. I look forward to talking at you, I guess. Until next week, happy training.
Thanks for listening. To find the show notes for this episode and to find even more helpful articles and training tips, head over to my website, wonderpupstraining.com. You can even grab a free PDF template to help you plan your training sessions and stay organized. Until next time, I'm Hannah Branigan. Happy training. Cheers.